This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Most of the constitutions across the continent did not foresee a COVID-19 and so did not make provision for the possibility that the end date of presidential terms or parliamentary terms could be tempered with.
That's Dr. Chris Famunyo, a director at the National Democratic Institute, on COVID-19's impact on election in Africa in the near future. Details coming up. Also, Al-Qaeda and Islamic State, once friends, are now fighting against each other in Mali and Burkina Faso. And Nigerian scientists say the country's research institute and personnel can produce a homegrown vaccine to fight COVID-19. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. The COVID-19 crisis is threatening to scrap elections in Africa for the near future. Watchdog groups are concerned that the emergency, with its corresponding lockdowns and other restrictive measures, will jeopardize democracy on the continent. Many African observers are also warning that coronavirus is providing a perfect cover for some political leaders to become increasingly autocratic and to abuse their powers. Darren Taylor reports.
Pro-democracy organizations point out that an election is a long process, with different phases that should culminate in citizens participating in free and fair polls that bolster democracy. But now, because of COVID-19, some of these phases, such as big political rallies, probably won't happen.
Most of the constitutions across the continent did not foresee a COVID-19, and so did not make provision for the possibility that the end date of presidential terms or parliamentary terms could be tempered with.
Dr. Chris Famunyo is a director at the National Democratic Institute, an international non-profit. He says Africa's going to be dealing with the political fallout from the pandemic for a long time. In Ethiopia, for example, postponed polls threatened to result in an illegitimate government.
The national election body came to the conclusion that with COVID-19, it would be impossible to organize meaningful elections.
Famunyo says other leaders, such as in Burundi and Tanzania, have their heads in the sand.
You have almost a state of denial in terms of the real impact of COVID-19, and therefore a willingness to proceed with the electoral process as if the pandemic was not in existence.
That will only end badly, says the analyst, and it's doubtful whether opposition parties in Burundi and Tanzania will have the space they need to compete. But Famunyo says the current rulers are taking a big gamble by ignoring the severity of the crisis, and their power may be eroded if one crucial point comes into play.
Whether the governmental management of the pandemic itself becomes a political and election-related issue in which the governments could rise or fall without citizens gauge their management of COVID-19.
He says elections always hold important themes, but that some countries are supposed to deal this year with issues of utmost significance to their future as democracies.
In the Central African Republic, there's a desire by the executive branch to introduce legislation that would amend the constitution to allow the president to be able to extend his term of office.
Malawi is supposed to go to the polls in July after a court ruled that the May 2019 election, which saw incumbent President Peter Mutharika re-elected, needed to be rerun because of irregularities. But, says Famunyo, it's doubtful whether Malawi's vote will happen in a few months' time.
Or whether civil society and especially the security services will be able to conduct themselves in a way that would allow citizens either to participate in the elections or should they be moved forward to create an environment where the country can continue to stay stable until those elections are conducted.
But there's hope, says Fumunyo, in Burkina Faso and Niger.
These two countries are in the Sahel and therefore under tremendous stress because of their efforts to counter extremism, but where we see enormous political will to do the right thing.
Under conditions more difficult than those faced by most other African countries, says Fumunyo, Burkina Faso and Niger seem dedicated to conducting inclusive elections and to entrenching democracy. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State group have often worked in tandem for years in the Sahel, coordinating attacks and even swapping fighters. But since the beginning of the year, sporadic clashes between the two appear to have escalated into full-blown combat in central Mali and Burkina Faso. The UN Special Representative in Mali said the jihadist civil war is no longer a secret and nobody knows where it is going to end. Each one wants to get the upper hand over the other. VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shenawi spoke with Joseph Siegel, director of research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies in Washington, about these developments.
I should clarify that the clashes that we're hearing about happen between the Al-Qaeda coalition in the Sahel, which was under the acronym JNIM or JSIM, and the group, Islamic State in Sahara, or ISGS. These groups have pledged allegiance to the respective global rival jihadist factions, Al-Qaeda and ISIS, are very closely aligned. ISGS group is actually an offshoot of the Al-Qaeda network. And so the point is there's been a high degree of collaboration and cooperation between these groups over the years. And so the fact that we've seen clashes here over the last couple of months, it's noteworthy because there's been some sort of rupture that's occurred. But I think it's important to keep in mind that this is a local difference that has emerged. It isn't necessarily a reflection of something that's happening at the global level in terms of rivalries between ISIS and Al-Qaeda. In terms of why it's happened, it's a combination of competition over fighters, over territory, access to different extorted revenues that the groups can control, and indeed leadership rivalries and competition that exists between the groups.
But Saleh Al-Nadif, the United Nations Special Representative in Mali, said that the jihadist civil war is no longer a secret and nobody knows where it is going to end, because each one wants to get the upper hand over the other. Is that a temporary conflict, or there are reasons to expect a continuous conflict between the two groups?
Well, it's really too early to tell. Prior to the forming of the Al-Qaeda coalition in 2017, we regularly saw clashes between the various groups in the Sahel. You know, it's a very fragmented theater of militant groups. With a notable, since then, is the degree to which they haven't been fighting. And so in some ways, the recent clashes are a reversion to what we saw prior to 2013. I think the question of how long it will last will really depend how deep the rupture is. If these are real fundamental differences, it may be an ongoing phenomenon that continues, much as we saw previously. If it is more localized or on a peripheral matter, it's possible that they will be able to reconcile their differences and resume the high level of cooperation they've had up until recently.
Al-Qaeda-affiliated jihadists now grouped under an alliance named GSIM first emerged in northern Mali in 2012 and then established themselves in central Mali in 2015, while the Islamic State group presence came later. What are the reasons behind the two groups' ability to recruit followers in this region?
Yeah, there is an ideological element. There have been very concerted efforts to radicalize the local communities and then use that as a recruitment tool. Income plays a factor. These are very impoverished areas, and so the access to any income these groups can provide is an important incentive. But I would mostly emphasize focus that they've brought on grievances. And there's been a very strong messaging element of recruitment that hypes up the feelings of marginalization that many of these communities feel. And militant groups have blamed the government for the poverty and the sense of, you know, social and political marginalization that many of these communities feel. They very intentionally have tried to play the intercommunal differences between groups, and in particular targeting the Fulani ethnic group, which are mostly pastoralists, and playing into their grievances vis-a-vis some of the neighboring groups, some of which are farmer communities. And so that way use those local tensions as a way of recruiting for their militant group. However, the vast majority of these communities do not support the militant groups. And as a result, we have seen the militants targeting these communities as a form of intimidation, and they've been killing community leaders who refuse to cooperate. And so I think there's a high degree of coercion that's involved in what we're seeing on the ground in these areas.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies in Washington, speaking with VOA Senior Analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. Burundi's presidential candidates have promised to respect the result of yesterday's election, which took place without violence. VOA Central Africa Service Managing Editor Frederick Nkundiji says turnout was high despite the COVID-19 pandemic. Preliminary results are expected next week, with final results to follow on June 4th. Meanwhile, the top U.S. diplomat for Africa, Tibor Nash, says he commends the Burundians for what he calls a peaceful commitment to the democratic process and exceptional turnout. Nash urged all sides in Burundi to continue to refrain from provocation in the days to come. However, the head of the UN's Commission of Inquiry on Burundi told German radio that the election was neither credible nor free because there were no international observers monitoring the vote. VOA's Nkundiji reports that Burundi's government dismissed that accusation. Nigerian scientists say the country's research institutes and personnel can produce a homegrown vaccine to fight COVID-19. The country's central bank plans to support the research with a grant of $259 million. Mike Mbonye has more from Lagos.
Professor Tunde Salako is the Director General of the Nigerian Institute of Medical Research. Salako says he welcomes the central bank's plans to support production of homegrown vaccine to fight the coronavirus. He says lack of funds has impeded research in the country. Salako says the offer from the central bank will fast-track the processes leading to the production of a vaccine.
It is not the technical know-how that we don't have. We have researchers within the universities and the institutes that have this knowledge, that have traveled and have gained this knowledge. They have collaborators and networks that can make it happen, but there is really no financial back.
Salako says government research institutes and private biotechnology companies can collaborate and produce what he calls a candidate vaccine.
If they can put their hands together, I believe that it is very possible for us to at least develop some kind of candidate vaccine. It can be tested. Determining whether it will be effective or not may be another issue. But that we can produce a candidate vaccine should not be a problem. One, the methods that are being used to produce vaccines are known worldwide. They are not secret any longer. And so it can be domesticated anywhere.
The Central Bank of Nigeria says it will support the domestic production of a vaccine with 100 billion naira or $259 million. The bank says the grant will be used to support researchers, science institutions, and biotechnology firms in the quest to produce a coronavirus vaccine in Nigeria. This is Mike Mbonye for VOA News in Lagos.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Here's a recap of our top stories. The COVID-19 crisis is threatening to scrap elections in Africa for the near future. Al-Qaeda and Islamic State, once friends, are now fighting against each other in Mali and in Burkina Faso. And Burundi's presidential candidates have promised to respect the results of yesterday's elections. Thanks for listening to VOA Africa. And for more news and information, visit our website at voanews.com. Zimbabwe's lockdown to fight the COVID-19 pandemic has lasted more than a month with no end in sight. The government is now using lockdown measures as a step towards monopolizing public transportation. Reporter Kudzai Zanawashi has the details.
Before the lockdown, Zimbabwe's public transport sector was serviced by both government-owned company, ZUPCO, and by private operators. Privately owned vehicles, however, were pushed off the roads when Zimbabwe went into lockdown on March 30th. Zimbabwe President Emmerson Mnangagwa recently continued that restriction.
Commuter omnibuses, combis, and registered taxis also remain banned. Only ZUPCO buses and the ZUPCO contracted commuter omnibuses with the stipulated number of passengers and adhering to the sanitization and disinfection regulations will be permitted to operate.
However, it appears this is not just a temporary measure for public health. Zimbabwe's biggest weekly state-run publication recently reported the government intends to permanently ban privately owned vehicles in public transportation, except for those that have signed up to work with ZUPCO. That includes drivers of minibuses or combis. Tafazwa Goliati is the president of the Passenger Association of Zimbabwe.
Government suggests bringing order in the CBD of Harare and other towns is good. But as Passenger Association of Zimbabwe, we are against the idea of bringing the monopoly back because our members will suffer. The government must not take advantage of COVID-19 to disadvantage indigenous people in this business. There will be no competition among the competitors. As we can see, most of these operators, they are not willing to join the ZUPCO franchise.
Goliati says the new policy is a disaster waiting to happen, noting the government struggles to meet its monthly financial obligations. He says those who have signed up with ZUPCO may withdraw their vehicles when they are not paid on time, leaving commuters stranded. He says historically, ZUPCO model as a monopoly has not done well.
Since 1990 to 1993, we had monopoly. Government removed that monopoly. They introduced the other players, independent players, and there was competition. It was health. As Passenger Association of Zimbabwe, we are saying these independent operators, they should belong to association of their choice.
Goliati with the Passenger Associations of Zimbabwe, he has taken the government to court regarding the matter. However, some passengers like the new plan. Since the government subsidizes public transportation through ZUPCO, so commuting may be more affordable. Private transportation operators are known for hiking their fees when there is high demand, such as when it rains or when fuel prices go up. In the capital, Harare, in some towns, they often pick up passengers at unapproved areas and end up in dangerous cat-and-mouse chases with authorities. Under COVID-19 preventative measures, fewer people will be allowed to board each vehicle and they will be required to maintain some distance from other passengers. That means private operators might raise their fees to make a profit since they can carry fewer people. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashi from Harare.
A Kenyan scientist has won one of the world's most prestigious conservation awards for his work to protect a critically endangered antelope. Abdullahi Hussein Ali won a Whitley Award known as the Oscars of the conservation world for his work to save the Hirola antelope that lives along the Kenya-Somali border. The Hirola is a brown antelope with spiraled horns and white facial patterns, and there are only about 500 of them alive today. The Whitley Fund for Nature, which gives out the annual award, says the Hirola is arguably the world's most endangered antelope species. For more, VOA's Jason Patenkin spoke with Ali from his hometown of Garissa in northeastern Kenya.
What was it like when you won the award? How did you react and how did that feel?
It was really an exciting moment. As you know, the Whitley is a very prestigious award. It's the Oscars of the conservation. It was really a long shot for an indigenous conservationist who works in a region like where I work, really unknown. So it was really surprising that I got the Whitley Award.
You've been working with the Hirola, which is this antelope in northeastern Kenya. Can you tell us a bit about the Hirola? What is the current status of the Hirola?
So the Hirola is very rare antelope in areas along the Kenya-Somali border. It's a critically endangered species, and there are only like 500 of them left. I'm sort of the first indigenous person from this region to do a comprehensive conservation effort to reverse the trends, the negative trends that have been ongoing since the 1970s. So my work both contributed a sort of a community support and also advanced the biology of this species.
Why is the Hirola so important, especially for the people and for the environment of northeastern Kenya and southwestern Somalia?
There's nothing like it. It's an evolutionary distinct species, globally endangered, and is the only living member of the genus. So if we lose the Hirola, we are not losing a species only, we are losing an entire genus. They are so unique and also represent a unique cultural significance to the local communities in this region. You know, it's our pride, sort of our national animal in this region.
You help manage a conservancy for the Hirola in northeastern Kenya, but it's not only the Hirola that benefits from this. There are many other species, many other animals that benefit from the preservation of the Hirola. Is that correct?
Correct. So my approach is sort of a landscape approach to the conservation of Hirola. The natural range of the Hirola antelope is both on the Kenya and the Somalia border. And of course, there's nothing much going on the Somali side, but for the Kenyan side, it's sort of still a huge landscape, or over 17,000 square kilometers. So we are supporting communities to run community protected areas in this part of the Hirola range. And it's protecting so many other species that are also vulnerable, including, you know, African elephants, lions, giraffes, lesser kudu, oribis, and oryx that are also facing serious threats, including habitat loss, you know, poaching, and other emerging threats like infrastructure that are coming up.
What are some of the most important things that can be done right now to protect the Hirola and the other animals that live with the Hirola in this unique landscape?
Of course, habitat loss is a primary issue for many large mammals in different parts of the world. So a starting point will be protecting the habitat and the space that they need to thrive, in addition to involving local communities in management of these species. You know, that includes managing, you know, grazing systems. It includes doing active anti-poaching patrols and also planning for future expansion of their space that they have. In addition, we are doing a lot of awareness programs for the local communities to ensure that they are involved in the long term. So the long term survival of Hirola and many other wildlife is hinged on the tolerance of these local communities. So we are making sure that they are involved and, you know, they take the future of this species in their own hand.
How will winning this award help you to help the Hirola?
Sure. You know, it will help me scale up the current effort I'm doing, as well as, you know, scaling up some of the work I've been doing for the past decade to ensure that the future of this species is secured.
That was award-winning Kenyan scientist Abdullahi Hussein Ali speaking with VOA's Jason Patenkin. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiji Suhibi in Washington for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7. Visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thanks again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.